Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. From time to time, we like to provide you with an opportunity to ask some basic questions about personal finance. Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, drops by pretty much every month to answer your questions about money management. Whether you're just starting out and looking for advice on investing, thinking about buying a home, maybe sending your kids to college, planning for retirement, or if you're not in a position to save very much right now, but you are trying to address maybe some mounting debt or trying to figure out a way to save even a little bit of cash for a rainy day or just want to know how some elements of the financial system work, all of those and other questions about personal finance are welcome this morning. Kevin Waspy, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you, Craig. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Hope you had a great holiday.
Great Thanksgiving. Much to be thankful for, and I believe that we all do if we just sit back and think about it.
Indeed. As we begin our discussion, we hope you will call in with your personal finance questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And we also welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Now, remember, I'm happy to throw out all sorts of questions about your money to Kevin. It would probably be best, though, if you called and asked him yourself. The phone number is again 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. With so much attention, Kevin, on the so-called fiscal cliff and what may be coming at the federal level, I thought it might be a good idea for us to start by talking in some detail about decisions that we may have to make about our money between now and the end of next month. First of all, what does it mean for each of us individually if no compromise is reached?
Well, I think what is probably in the cards, at least in no progress or no change, let's put it that way, is certainly a return to tax situations that were higher. So one example that may impact most of our listeners, we've been seeing the payroll tax. So this would be the amount taken for payment into Social Security. That payroll tax for the employee has been reduced 2%. And the theory behind this has been more disposable income in the pockets of consumers, that will expire.
And that was temporary. That was just a year or two, right?
Right. That was a temporary measure extended twice.
Okay.
So welcome to the definition of temporary. but bottom line is the current 2012 rate of withholding on employee wage is 4.2%, and that will rise back to its regular or normal or customary or prior to the decline 6.2%. Again, it doesn't take a lot of arithmetic. Basically, take your annual income, use that 2%, and say that that amount of money will not be take-home pay in the future. Those kinds of things are, I would say, easy to figure. Things that are less easy to figure is perhaps what happens to your rate of taxation. And that, again, is going to depend upon your taxable income in a given year. If your taxable income doesn't change much in a given year, as it probably does not for many people, then you're going to look at the opportunity to see income tax brackets go back to higher rates. So rather than a 10% rate of taxation on smaller incomes, that will go back to a 15% level. 25 goes back to 28. 28 goes back to as high as perhaps 39.6. So all of those things are, pre-programmed if no changes are made to them now. The other item, and again, this is kind of getting into the, you know, we're verging off of the what's controllable, what's not controllable, but things like estate taxes are certainly a big change. Estate taxes change considerably. In the current year, estates valued less than $5 million basically pay no estate tax at all. That returns to an era or a scheme where estates with a value greater than $1 million are taxed at a 55% rate. So again, just soup to nuts, things like withholding tax rising a small amount, things like estate taxes jumping quite considerably could have big changes.
There's the end of the Bush era tax cuts, some tax breaks for businesses, some taxes related to health care all would kick in unless they come to some other conclusion. Part of it also is, at least according to the Congressional Budget Office, that if all of that occurs, it would cut gross domestic product by 4% next year. And so that would potentially lead to recession again. Then the question is, does unemployment go up? So when we look at those big picture figures, how can we apply them to our own finances?
Well, and that's the difficult thing to do now that we're in the 30th of November. I would hesitate to guess for any single person, but I would say pretty much as a general rule, there's probably little any of us individually can do with 31 days left in the year to change much of what's happened already. The exception would be something, perhaps a person who's self-employed. If a self-employed person could accelerate income into this year in anticipation of an increase in taxes in the future, well, then those are planning decisions that could be made now. On an individual level where we're not talking about a person self-employed, can I increase a benefit to myself in the coming 31 days? And I'm kind of scratching my head, struggling to say, well, I'm coming up with a blank.
So it's the old axiom, you know, you make a plan for the long term and you stick to it and you don't worry about the short term.
Well, and again, I think that's the most prudent thing to do, whether it's an event like this fiscal cliff and all of the wrangling about changes in the tax code or any other event that comes, how should we say, totally outside of the control of a person trying to get by day to day and trying to make a plan for future financial security. Exactly.
What about other things you should think about related to your finances in the final month of the year, maybe charitable giving or some other things? What should you think about?
Charitable donations are certainly a part of many people's plannings, whether it's funding the programs that are offered on WILL TV
and radio.
I wasn't
trying to set you up for that.
Or other such worthy causes. But again, I think in most people's circumstances, that's pretty much a budgeting decision that they will make at the beginning of the year and come to, enact throughout the year. If I were to be, and this might be a little bit counterintuitive, but it might also be a little bit harsh from WILL's point of view, if I really were to think that I have not yet made all the charitable contributions this year that I was budgeting to make, and I anticipated the tax rates would rise considerably next year, I'd probably postpone making those charitable contributions. I'd keep you guys hanging a little bit longer.
All right, well, thank you for the first comment. Not so much for the second, but so be it.
Welcome to the two sides of every coin.
That's right. I guess one other thing to say about charitable contributions in general is that there are lots of ways to support various charities beyond writing a check.
Oh, absolutely. Part of the charitable giving that people, you know, at a point in their life realize is that cash contributions are important. Contributions of time, contributions of effort, volunteerism, and obviously contribution of assets that could be set up in a way of entrusting them that generate income for almost perpetuity. Those kinds of things are certainly, you know, important planning decisions, usually for people in the later stages of their lives.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Kevin Wasby. He lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. He's here to answer your questions about personal finance. That could mean everything from how to pay off student debt, to how to deal with your day-to-day expenses, to how to save for a rainy day or for retirement, if or when and how to take the plunge into home ownership, how in the world you'll send your kids to college while you're still paying off your college loans, whatever the case may be, whatever's on your mind about your money and how best to save it and invest it, Kevin is here to offer his best suggestions. Just call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, or you can email your questions to will-talk at illinois.edu. We'll begin this morning with Tom in Cloverdale, Indiana. Tom, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I listen to the University of Illinois a lot on the AM station because I can get it over here on the Indiana board. My question is, what do I need to look for when I'm setting up a trust? We have 401ks and IRAs and things like that, and I'm retired and I've got two grown children, and I want to make sure that when I set up this trust that I know what I need to take into account. My kids are 24 and 28 years old. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye. Thanks for the call. What do you do to set up a trust? What do you have to think about?
A great question, and let me begin with what's maybe not so obvious, but maybe an oversimplification. A trust is a legal document. It sets up an entity for a variety of different purposes. And I think one of the most important things about it is to find an attorney that is not only knowledgeable in the practice of these types of instruments, but also, like your own physician, someone that you would, how should we say, have a rapport with. Mm-hmm. How do we find an attorney to do that if we're not familiar with one at the moment? If I move to a different community and I have to establish a relationship with a new physician, I try to talk with people and establish that rapport, or at least begin to get some leads in hopes of establishing that rapport with a new person through word of mouth. So I would suggest to the caller that they talk with associates, friends, perhaps people that of their same age group that have already done these types of things. And who did they use? What are the, feelings they have for those advisors, and work with them. A trust is, again, depending on the form of trust, whether it's a revocable or irrevocable trust and the prerogatives that go along with it, can be something that could be very different than a circumstance of not having a trusted relationship. Bottom line is find a good, competent attorney that you're comfortable in dealing with. It's like a menu. After you get to that point, you basically say, what is involved in this type of trust? How does it work? What benefits? What disadvantages? And then it's a decision-making process.
How is it different from, say, a living will or something like that?
Well, when we think about things like living wills, we're talking about documents that are very changeable. The difference between a revocable and an irrevocable trust is exactly as the word would imply. Once in place, an irrevocable trust is difficult to undo. There are different advantages conveyed in an irrevocable trust. And some of those advantages might seem attractive on the surface, but things in the future are unknown. So as conditions play out and circumstances change, the opportunity to find those advantages, at least initially, might be overweighed by some of the disadvantages down the road. Again, it's a complicated field. It's a field that requires a conversation with a person skillful in understanding both the benefits and the drawbacks of these types of arrangements.
I imagine one of the basic questions you might ask yourself as you get started with something like this is, how much money am I comfortable with setting aside, knowing full well I'm never, ever going to spend it, that it's going to be for my kids, it's going to be for whoever I'm setting this up for, and it's, once this is written and done, it's gone in terms of anything that I might possibly ever need to use, right?
That could certainly be a component of it, depending upon the structure of the trust and the terms of it. Those types of things, and, you know, literally thinking about the whole philosophy of, trusted arrangements for the benefits of heirs, we could really sit down and start perhaps with a philosophical discussion. That's one example of a philosophy. Another example of a philosophy quite different might be the bumper sticker on the $350,000 motorhome that says, I am spending my children's inheritance. So somewhere between the two extremes in a philosophy, Then again, getting into the details and the benefits and drawbacks and so on and so forth.
I suppose people also sometimes put conditions in those too, like provided the following circumstances happen, then, you know, my son, my daughter, my whoever receives this.
Sure. And
all
again,
of that can be written in.
And again, some of the, philosophical leanings that might be put into a legal document and how holding those leanings are. Again, this is all of the advice of a good, competent attorney who practices in this area that you could build a rapport with and, get the best advice from.
All right. Let's take another call. We have Bill on the line from Champaign. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How's it going?
Well, how are you?
Doing well. Doing well. I had a question about life insurance. 30 years old and married, and my wife doesn't really work where you've got young children, babies in the house. And I've currently got about $180,000 of term life insurance through my work and was considering getting additional life insurance, since if something were to happen to me, it would kind of be a large strain on my family, and was debating between getting additional term life insurance or starting a whole life insurance policy, and wasn't quite sure how the whole life insurance policy would pay out if something were to happen in the more near future rather than down the road.
That's a great question. Great question. Let's just define a couple of terms real quickly and then probably go from there, and I'll quickly get into my opinions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So for the benefit of all of the listeners, and I'm sure, Bill, you know this, term life insurance is a little bit like buying the insurance that we buy on our house or on our car. We pay a premium. It's good for a length of time, and if damage occurs during that covered period, we have reimbursement against the insurance company. So as it goes to life insurance, term life insurance, as long as we pay the premium, there's a death benefit in place. And you also mentioned that this term life insurance currently in place that you have is through your employer. So again, it's not uncommon that as one of the employee benefits in many jobs throughout the private and public sector is the provision for a certain amount of term life insurance. There's two risks to the way that term life insurance is structured for you. The first is obviously if you change or lose your job, then obviously as a condition of employment, that ability to have access to that term life insurance goes away. Now, there might be a provision in the employee benefit package that allows you to pick that term life insurance up on your own, but in most circumstances, that takes it outside of the group purchase rate, which makes it become, more expensive than it is while you're working. So that's first risk. It's linked to your current job. Second risk is term life insurance over time will become more expensive. So again, no surprise here. The older we get, the older we are expected to live, which is the good thing. But the bad thing is the older we get, the closer we actually get to our ultimate demise. The life insurance people like to call that an untimely demise. I've never seen a timely demise, so I don't really get that aspect of it, but that's kind of a joke we'll put aside. Bottom line is this. Term life insurance is great for temporary needs to replace income. For instance, you have a circumstance where for the next 10 or 15 years, there's a burden to retire a debt, let's say a home mortgage. Term life insurance matched to that type of obligation might be a very, very cost-effective way of doing it. But if we're thinking about a family and continuing needs of spouse, children, so on and so forth, we probably want to turn our attention to more things that could be planned on and permanent. So let's talk about whole life or permanent life insurance. Unlike term insurance, whole life insurance basically is predicated on a payment of a certain amount as long as you live. Now, we could quickly change that and talk about a single premium whole life insurance policy, but let's not go there for the moment. A whole life insurance policy locks in the amount of payment that you make, for as long as you live. And at some point in the future, perhaps depending upon the features of the contract, you could actually quit making payments and the amount of death benefit would be there regardless. The one nice thing about whole life insurance is this. As long as you pay the premium, you have the coverage. It's not conditioned on your place of employment. It's not going to have an increasing cost over time. It's also going to give you a benefit of having a buildup of cash value. So this is the amount of accumulated earnings within the policy that grows tax-deferred, could be even tax-exempt, depending upon how the policy is actually realized. So I guess those are the big differences. Now, real quickly, in my opinion, everyone with dependents should have some amount of whole life insurance. I personally have $150,000 death benefit in two different whole life policies. I bought them when I was about 30 years old, and I still pay on them. And the reason I have them is because regardless of what happens, at least that amount will be there to satisfy the needs of my dependents. Period. End of story.
Kevin, Bill noted that he also has some small children at home, and I'm wondering if something else he might want to consider is taking out even a small amount of policies on the children that they could then take control of when they become adults, if for no other reason than the rates, the amount that they pay will probably be far less over time because all of the factors that go into how much your insurance policy may cost you year to year, you know, they're obviously non-smokers. They're mm-hmm. obviously in good, you know, medical condition compared to where they will be 30, 40, 50, 60 years down the road.
Right. Those types of opportunities are there, and that could be a component in planning for a child's financial security, a child's financial future. So that's an element that I would say, in my opinion, kind of gets into the excess. If we have the ability to do so, that might be a small way to begin a savings habit.
All right, let's go next to Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning to you all. I would like to go back to the fiscal cliff sort of conversation and precisely about taxation. And I'm extremely naive here, but correct me if I'm wrong. The government or whoever doesn't take all your money when they tax you. They only take a percentage. And the services that are provided for us as citizens are really something we all need. So why do so many people get so upset because they're getting taxed a little bit more when, in all essence, you get this money back, except for maybe the very, very wealthy who cannot possibly get back as much as they would be paying in taxes. But at the same time, in the situation we live in, they have the advantage of being able to make so much money. And if they want more, just make a little bit more. Why do we always go back to this tax problem?
Okay, that's a very big picture question, Kevin.
Well, a great question. I guess where would I start? Maybe it's a philosophical issue. If we were to sit down and say that, you know, I have a certain set of beliefs or preferences or even biases, and the person in discussion with me has a very different set of conditions, expectations, perhaps biases, we could have a discussion that would go on ad infinitum about why one system that works in one way is better than or worse than another way. And I'm thinking about a basic, you know, just in an economic sense. If you believe collectivism is better than capitalism, we could have that debate. And if I believe collectivism is better than capitalism and you take the capitalism side, we could have that debate.
But, you know, I think it's really, though, more the debates we have are more like variations on capitalism, that it's just grades, you know, gradations, if you will.
Oh, absolutely.
It's, you know, one side kind of wants a little more taxation on this group and another side wants a little more on this group or vice versa. And it has more to do with that and less to do with overarching economic philosophies.
Sure. And again, getting back to the question of the caller, I guess what I'll confess is this. I can't answer the question. I guess the only thing I'm going to do is opine.
You're saying you can't solve all of our political problems in 30 seconds?
Well, that, I think you're reading my mind, Craig. But what I was going to do is opine on something. And I wonder if this is just the basic nature of a political process, much more so than an economic or budgeting type of process. Politics is a weird animal. I would never confess to understand it.
I want to remind you, you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois. It's our regular program on personal finance, and we welcome your questions on money management, whether you are seeking investment advice, considering maybe a large purchase like a home or a car, maybe trying to deal with bills, both large and small, maybe planning for retirement, whatever is on your mind about your money these days. We welcome you to the conversation. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We have an email, someone asking, I've recently taken a substantial distribution from a traditional IRA, a CD, and plan to take up to 60 days to reinvest in another IRA. However, I have heard that neither stocks through a mutual fund nor bonds are a good investment these days. What would you recommend? And then there's a second question. If no deal is reached regarding the fiscal cliff, do you anticipate that the market will tank? If so, would it be prudent to wait until after the first of the year and then invest in a mutual fund?
Two good questions. Let me make sure I understand the question. The money is in an IRA.
Yep, in a traditional IRA.
Okay, and there is a maturity of a certificate of deposit.
That's what I would infer from the email.
And I had the sense that there was a 60-day window mentioned.
Right, to reinvest in another IRA.
Okay, so my hope would be, but maybe I'm wrong here. My hope would be that the money is still within a tax-sheltered account called in a traditional IRA. The fact that the CD has matured is just, an item of an investment opportunity that's now come due. If the money was literally distributed from the traditional IRA, then the 60-day window is a window of opportunity to roll it into another traditional IRA and not have to pay current year tax on it. Okay, so I want to make sure I understand that. And what I would caution the person authoring this email is about the following. Don't wait to the 59th day. If indeed you did have a distribution that's taxable, and in April or March when you begin doing income tax, don't be surprised that you will have a little bit of paperwork if indeed this money has been distributed from an individual IRA in qualifying for, proving that the money is not taxable income, because a 1099 will be created by the institution that had the traditional IRA, if it indeed was distributed, showing all of that amount as taxable income. So I caution people when they have IRAs, if they're thinking of moving them or putting, you know, a different investment mix in play or moving to a different custodian or whatever, do it as a direct transfer from custodian to custodian, and avoid a distributable event. If the distributable event has occurred, if literally the money has come out of the maturity of a CD and now is paid to the person as an individual, then I'm just going to say be very cautious. Don't wait until the 59th day and be prepared to have a good, solid record to furnish with your coming year's tax return, unless you want to call all of that money taxable income. Now, let's get to the investment question.
Yeah.
Where you put it depends on so many other things. So many other things like where your assets are now. I'd like to see some exposure to a variety of asset classes, and without any kind of background on what it is the person has in play right now for retirement savings, kind of difficult to answer. But when I say things like I'd like to see a representation across a variety of asset classes, fixed income, equities, maybe even real estate through something like REITs, all of those things are things to consider. And I would say don't matter what happens with fiscal cliff or lack of fiscal cliff. What do I think the market is going to do? Doesn't matter. The market will do what it's going to do. And if this has any length of time for retirement use, if the person is not literally of retirement age, it won't matter in the long run.
We're taking your questions on personal finance for Kevin Waspy, who lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. By the way, do you prefer finance or finance?
However you choose.
All right. Just curious about that. He's here to offer his best wisdom about everything from paying off debt to dealing with day-to-day expenses to saving for a rainy day or for retirement. Whatever is on your mind about your money and how best to save it and invest it, we welcome your phone call this morning at 333-9455 or outside the 217. You can call 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we will take more of your calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus.
Is it okay to break up with someone with an email? If you're out at a restaurant with someone, is it rude to answer your cell phone, check email, or tweet? On the next Fresh Air, we get answers from Philip Galanis, who writes an etiquette column for the New York Times. His book, Social Cues, is now out in paperback. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For 20 years, Silver Creek has been bringing to the table freshly baked artisan breads, prime steaks and chops, fresh fish and pasta dishes, and delightful pastries made by Silver Creek's pastry chef.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and pretty much every month, Kevin Waspy joins us to take your questions on personal finance. Kevin lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, and whether you're just starting out and looking for advice on paying the bills, saving and investing, or maybe thinking about leaving the apartment rental behind and maybe buying a home, or if you're trying to figure out how to afford college for your kids or maybe planning for retirement, whatever is on your mind about your money and how to keep your financial house in order, your questions are welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll go next to Nate in Champaign. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. My question is just for a young person who's recently out of school and just has a job and has no debt, no house, no kids, and I guess a good income. What is a good thing to do just to plan for the future, you know, whether it's to buy a house or retirement? I'm still young. I'm just 24. I have a 401k with my employer, and besides that, I've done nothing, just unsure of what to do. So what's a good way to go forward?
Sure. Those are great questions. If I could ask one thing, on the 401k plan with your employer, are you deferring a little bit, enough to maximize the employer match?
Yes.
All of the, you know, are you deferring as much as you can?
I'm deferring as much as, there was a worksheet and it tells me how much I should put in, and I followed that and I have it in a Roth account.
Okay. So, if your If you're deferring as much as you can under the current tax code, if you're hitting the dollar limitations, that's probably a very good first habit. As you well know, it's money that never hits your paycheck, so you can't use it for other things. One of the things that I like to see young people do is begin to set their standard of living based on their take-home pay after they make these kinds of decisions rather than before they make these kinds of decisions. So if you've done that, I commend you. Beyond that, the opportunity you have in saving money, long-term retirement-type money, in addition to something like a 401k plan, would be a Roth IRA. The advantages to you in each year you're deferring don't save you any payment of taxes, but the advantages come in, how should we say, the future, in non-payment of taxes at time of distribution. So I would consider a Roth IRA as a companion with something in addition to the employer 401k plan. On top of that, just a good old basic savings account. There's never, how should we say, there's never a way to say what might be tomorrow. And a loss of a job, some type of unfortunate event happens that might really set your world upside down. You certainly want to have, I would say, 3, 4, maybe 6 months of your gross income set away in a safe savings account. Literally something that, you know, you might be rolling over in CDs or have accessible a part to in literally a passbook savings account. And I think you probably ought to think about the ownership of your own home. And that's going to be dependent upon whether you think you're going to be living in the same area, working at the same employer, so on and so forth. But there are obvious advantages to owning over renting, and it goes well beyond things like tax advantages.
What about the very basic question of what percentage of your income should you set aside specifically for retirement, and what percentage for that rainy day fund, that maybe 6 months worth of the income you're used to?
Right. It's going to depend on each person's position of how much the income is, obviously. But if I could reasonably expect to put together a rainy day fund, an emergency fund, 3 to 6 months of my gross income, if it takes me a year to save that much, if it takes me 2 years, the quicker I can get it done, the better off I am. As it goes to retirement savings, if I could maximize my dollar limitations each year, that would be great. And again, what percentage of that income is depends on what my income is, obviously.
What are the when you say maximizing the dollar, how much is that?
$12,500 per year in something like a 401k is a dollar limitation. So, you know, there's quite a lot of opportunity for a person that has, say, a $50,000 income. You could defer more than 20% of your pay to hit that dollar limitation.
That's quite a high percentage, quite
yes,
a chunk of change, though, to try and
sure it is. And
make
again,
happen.
These are goals. These are things that I try to advise people who are young, who are looking at employment packages, who are going to graduate in May, and they show me the 401k plan, and they say, well, let me get this right. If I defer this much, then I'll maximize the employer matching contribution. And I'll say, yeah, your arithmetic is good, but what if you deferred the maximum you were able to? Well, that'd cut back on my take-home pay. Exactly is my point. You will condition your standard of living to your take-home pay. If you make your retirement planning decisions after that, then you will be saving, in my opinion, less than you need to be. If you make those decisions after you make your planning decisions, you will have less take-home pay, and you will adjust your standard of living to that level. It's really difficult to go down in adjusting a standard of living. It's quite easy to go up, though. Mm. That's the upside potential you have.
Let's go next to Bill in Champaign. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a question with respect to dollar cost averaging.
Sure.
I understand that's advantageous when putting money or setting money aside for investments, retirements, et cetera. But how does one do the opposite of that after you've retired and taking money out? I've never heard any good explanation of how to do that.
Excellent question. Excellent question. The dollar cost averaging on the way in is something that uses volatility in your favor. So in other words, the same number of dollars, let's say each month, are buying different numbers of units of investments. So when the investment value goes up, I'm buying fewer units with those same number of dollars. When the investment value goes down, I am buying more of those units with the same number of dollars. We could think about the same thing in the distribution end, and that's a great way to do it. I would say you would regularly pull out a certain amount of money as needed. The distribution is going to be a fewer number of units when prices are higher, just like it was on the inside.
All right, Bill, thanks very much for the call. We'll go next to Jim in Bloomington. Hi, Jim.
Yes, my question is in regard to accelerated depreciation. My understanding is that that program is still in effect and is up to a value of $125,000 per year. Can you comment on that, please?
Not offhand. Are we talking about business? Are we talking about personal? Are we talking
this would be business.
What assets are we depreciating?
This would be equipment and machinery.
Yes. For certain classes of assets, those accelerated depreciation potentials are still in effect. The most generous of them ended at the end of 2011. It was basically a 100% cost recovery acceleration program. That part has come to an end.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I have to ask because I just have no idea what you guys were talking about in the last 40 seconds. What is accelerated depreciation? What are you talking about?
Depreciation, first of all, is the time expensing of an asset.
Right. So a value of your car depreciates over time.
Right.
Right.
So with a business acquisition of an asset, we pay for it up front. We're not allowed to expense the purchase, but we're required to time expense the purchase, the notion of depreciation. A simple or straight line method of depreciation would say, if the asset cost a dollar and it's going to be expected to last 5 years, then each year 20 cents would be an expense that I would reduce my taxable income by.
Okay.
So that 20 cents would be called depreciation, a non-cash expense. Accelerated depreciation methods allow me to have more of that amount of depreciation in the earlier years of a useful life. And it's just a way to, accelerate the recapture of the value of it vis-a-vis deducting from taxable income that amount of the asset used up.
Okay. Let's next go to Mike in Aurora, Illinois. Mike.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
This is just your personal opinion. I was wondering if you thought we would have a Santa Claus rally in the stock market here coming up, and with the uncertainty about the tax laws come January 1st, and when would that usually start?
Yeah, I wonder if we've already seen Santa Claus come, and now it's between the negotiations in D.C. over what does or doesn't happen. I mean, I that's a great question. Santa Claus rally, I mean, we all kind of laugh a little bit when we say it, but, you know, it's not unusual to see these types of things happen. I think there's so much, oh, God, I hate to say it this way, but I'll just put it straight out. I think there's so much wasted energy in all of what's going on with the wrangling on the tax policy, the fiscal cliff, however we want to summarize it, that the cross currents for any type of, what usually happens scenario are probably overridden. Here's what I'd say. Unless it's just pure speculation and we're just having fun flipping coins, I would say let's try to put that out of our minds, and let's just try to say Santa Claus, for the most part, is something that young children have fun believing in, and we probably ought to make decisions based on more prudent knowns.
Okay. Well, let me ask this, though. Every year around the holiday season, you know, we hit Thanksgiving, and there is so much attention towards consumerism, and naturally, we've sort of created this world where we make a point of going out and shopping around the Christmas holiday season. This year, we saw more and more stores open on Thanksgiving, trying to sort of boost that sense of consumerism and consumer spending. Does that naturally have an effect every year on not just those companies, but on stocks and the general mood and the general economy in the country?
Sure. I mean, it's no surprise to any investor that many retailers make the majority of their money around two times of the year. The first is back to school, and the second is holidays, so Christmas, end of year, so on and so forth. Again, that's not a big surprise to anyone. The notion of many retailers' sales are seasonal. What is perhaps the wild card is how much the expectations are borne out, or what amount of surprise, if any, occurs. An example, what would be from any given company or to a group of companies within an industry, if everyone anticipates that the retail sales of a certain clothing store are going to rise 3% this quarter, this calendar quarter, for the holidays, and they report a 4.5% rise, well, then guess what? You see the stock jump up. All of these types of temporary adjustments, I think, are trading opportunities that literally have nothing or anything to do with investing.
And yet, I wonder if it creates this artificial sense of economic activity, whether those numbers go up or down, whether they meet or fail to meet expectations. Someone's trying to take advantage of that, and the end result is that maybe there's more activity within the stock market, and so there are these natural, more dramatic jumps and drops and jumps and drops in the market during that period.
I think you're absolutely right. Anytime there's more, there's a higher probability for more news events, there's a higher probability for greater volatility. So, you know, news events themselves are important, but the difference between what was anticipated and what was reported gets to the opportunity for volatility. And again, seasonality tends to be more events for opportunities of volatility.
So getting back to Mike, to your question, it suggests to me that maybe Santa Claus constantly shows up, and it's just sometimes he's leaving coal.
Sometimes he leaves coal, and sometimes he doesn't.
All right.
Good way to put it, Craig.
Mike, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
And next up is Jeff in Piatone. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, great stuff, guys. I was getting a kick out of that, Santa Claus being a Grinch. Well, you know, I kind of look at this, and I don't trust the stock market. Watch that, and I kind of see how things are going as far as many people spending money. I have my own business, so I could tell just about what people are doing or not doing. But I tend to disagree with a lot of what the media has to say, because it seems like it's all about show and no tell, you know, show and tell, and not, you know, smoke and mirrors and not the truth. I've seen the country go down as far as, some people might be making money now, but it isn't like it used to be. And maybe I'm crazy, but it just seems to me like the value of the dollar is down, and everybody's house is down to 1980s levels. And as far as watching trends, I like where you guys are going a lot of this, but I'm just going by what the average Joe is doing. I just don't see it. I think the value of a house is never going to be like it was, you know, 2005 and 2006 again, at least in our lifetime. I think it's going to take so many years to recover. The stock market would have to go all the way up to like 17 before it would probably be high enough for somebody to be that comfortable. And honestly, the fiscal cliff is coming, and I think we'll work on it and probably get it solved, but I think it'll be a temporary thing. I'm looking at the big picture overall. I think this country is being brought down to the rest of the world's level. What do you guys think?
All right. Thanks for the call.
Lots of thoughts there.
We have just a minute or so left.
Yeah,
so.
And in just a minute or so, one to the remark of housing in 2005, 2006, it's my strong hope that housing prices never do what they did in 2005, 2006, which I think kind of was the epitome of the problems that we experienced. If I could look at a fair rate of return on an asset, I don't care what class it is, gold, real estate, stocks, bonds, whatever. If I could make 3% above the rate of inflation and compound that over a long period of time, I would do it and I would be happy. And I would say that was a successful measure of getting a rate of return. To the caller's mention of being in business for themselves, if they can extract that rate of return and more so to make up for the fact that their efforts, their energies, their talents go into their business, then I think that's all about economics. That's really what we're getting. I've never thought any investment market, whether it's stocks, bonds, commodities, whatever, I never thought it was a place to get rich quick, and I certainly never thought that about my own house.
And that's where we will have to leave it today. Kevin Wasby lectures on finance at the University of Illinois College of Business. Kevin, as always, thanks.
Thank you, Craig. Good to see you.
Good to see you. On Monday's show, we'll spend the first focus program of meteorological winter talking about winter weather and preparing you for the snow, sleet, ice, and whatever other forms of frozen precipitation may be headed our way in the coming months. Meteorologist Ed Kieser will join us to take your weather questions. Really, anything meteorological in nature will be welcomed. And we also may have some prizes to give away as part of a winter weather preparedness quiz, so I hope you'll tune in for that. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.